inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
This is a battle of worldview.
And we activate.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us today on the program. Walker Wildman here with you on The Core. And your host for each week are Walker Wildman, myself, and Rick Green. Or if you want to be proper, I would say Rick Green and I. That's the proper pronunciation and way to introduce yourself along with someone else.
You had it right.
Yeah, I learned that pretty soon, Bobby. Early age that it's not me and Bobby. It's Bobby and I. Those English tips go a long way. Hey, have I ever been known to eat my words? Oh yes, I have. And recently's no exception. So I told everyone that the Marriage Assembly Life registration is going to be closed. Told you it was going to be closed last week, and it was. And then we changed our mind. Hey, no, seriously, we've still got slots available. And the discussion late last week was, can we keep it open for a little bit longer? And the consensus was, yes, we can keep it open a little bit longer. So marriagefamilylife.net is that URL. Marriagefamilylife.net is that URL. July 6th through the 8th is when we're going to be having the Marriage Family Life Conference. This is our annual conference in Tupelo, Mississippi at the Cadence Bank Arena. And we want you and the entire family to come. So we're bumping this out to June 1. And I'm fairly confident that we're going to close registration on June 1. But I'm not going to say anything with absolute certainty because clearly I've been wrong before. No, we're going to bump this out a little bit, give some folks some more time to come in the door. MarriageFamilyLife.net's that URL. $75 for an adult, $50 for a child. That's for the entire conference, about 2.5 days. And we would love to see you at that event in July. So marriagefamilylife.net is where you can check that out. We're in Psalm chapter 72 for today. Psalm chapter 72. I want to read several verses here. And think of this when we're reading Psalm chapter 72. Think of the question, and I know it seems like such a foreign concept, but think to yourself, is it possible to have righteous leaders? Is it possible to have righteous leaders specifically in government? All right, so think of that as we read this. Psalm 72, verses 1 through 4. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to the royal son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. Let the mountains bear prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the children of the needy, and crush the oppressor. That's just verses 1 through 4 here, but the rest of the chapter continues a similar theme here. But, you know, today in 2023, we look around, especially in many nations around the world, the majority, I would say, and the people are begging the question. Now, the question begs itself, is there righteous leaders anymore? Are there righteous leaders anymore? And many of the times you say, no, there's not. But God desires righteous governments. God desires governments and leaders and people that promote and uphold biblical righteousness. And that's what we see here in Psalm chapter 72. David's saying, give the king, give the government leader your justice, O God. And he goes on here and begs that the king crush the oppressor, crush the evil man. And so there are historical and biblical accounts of righteous leadership. And so as Christians, that is what we should desire. We should desire to have godly leaders, to have leaders that uphold and affirm God's design for government and God's design for society. And we see this in Psalm chapter 72. Moving into some of the stories I want to get to today, speaking of righteous leaders and godly leaders, you know, in New York State and New York City, I mean, this is really a bastion of unrighteousness, if you will. I cover the story of this U.S. Marine vet and his tragic situation that he came across in the subway in New York City with a gentleman named Jordan Neely. So last week I went through Jordan Neely's rap sheet. For those who weren't listening and haven't caught up with this is the story of U.S. Marine vet getting in a scuffle on the train on the subway in New York City, and it ended tragically. All right, so this former U.S. Marine vet, this U.S. Marine vet Daniel Penny is his name. He came into contact with this serial assaulter and serial criminal on the subway track. And went to restrain him as he was being threatened to be assaulted, and others were going to become victim to this criminal. And Daniel Penny stepped into play, and restrained Jordan Neely, and it ended tragically. It ended in Jordan Neely's death. Now, when you watch the video and you read about the circumstances here, it doesn't appear that Daniel Penny, the U.S. Marine, it doesn't appear that he was going into this situation trying to kill Jordan Neely. It doesn't appear that way. Now, I'm not a reader of hearts or a reader of minds, and the criminal trial, the trial hasn't taken place yet, but he has been charged. Daniel Penny's been charged, by the way, as of late last week. So we don't know the intent of Daniel Penny. That what we know from the surface, it appears that he was just trying to defend others. He was trying to protect others from being assaulted and being victimized here, and it ended tragically. But I want to read this. I want to read further into Jordan Neely's criminal history. I told you last week he had 42 arrests, and I gave maybe a few examples, very surface level, not much detail. Fox has put out a very extensive background to these criminal cases, these arrests, and this really gives us, folks, we got to have the full picture here, and that's what I don't like about, you know, rushing to judgment hours after something tragic has happened and basically having, you know, a 15-minute trial on Twitter without knowing the full context. So what was Jordan Neely arrested 42 times for? Well, various things, and I read some of them last week, but let me read this report to you out of Fox News. Jordan Neely had a troubling history of violent attacks on strap hangers in New York City before the disturbed man reportedly threatened passengers and Marine vet Daniel Penny allegedly put him in a fatal chokehold. The 30-year-old vagrant who once performed as Michael Jackson impersonator had been arrested dozens of times, technically 42, including most recently for vicious assaults on subway riders. Court records show this was no saint. That's my commentary. In 2021, Neely socked a 67-year-old woman as she exited the Bowery Station in the East Village of Lower Manhattan. East Village in Lower Manhattan. The woman sustained a broken nose, a fractured orbital bone, and bruising, swelling, and substantial pain in the back of her head in the November 12th attack, according to a criminal complaint. Neely pleaded guilty to felony assault on February 9th in exchange for a 15-month alternative to incarceration program, according to the Manhattan DA's office. He was supposed to stay in a treatment facility and abstain from drugs. If he had completed the program, the felony assault would have been reduced to a misdemeanor. But he skipped a compliance court date and left the facility. A warrant was issued for his arrest on February 23rd. It wasn't immediately clear how long he spent in jail awaiting the resolution of the assault case. The troubled man, talking about Neely, who has a history of mental illness and drug addiction, had a difficult upbringing. His mother was strangled by her boyfriend in 2007 and found stuffed in a suitcase in the Bronx. Court records show that as an adult, Neely regularly lashed out at strangers on the subway and on the street. From January 2020 to August 2021, he was arrested for public lewdness after pulling down his pants and exposing himself to a female passenger. Misdemeanor assault for hitting a woman in the face. And criminal contempt for violating a restraining order. All three cases were dismissed as part of his February 9th plea deal. In June 2019, Neely attacked a lady, a 68-year-old lady, on the platform in Greenwich Village in New York. According to court papers, she testified, she stated, that out of nowhere, he punched me in the face, the victim told the New York Daily News. 1 month prior, he hit a man so hard in the face that he broke his nose on the platform at the Broadway Lafayette station, the same subway stop where he died 4 years later. For both 2019 cases, he pleaded guilty to misdemeanor assault and was sentenced to 6 months in jail. Outreach workers were so familiar with Neely that he was in the city's, quote, top 50 list, an internal roster kept by the Department of Homeless Services of people living on the street who were most in need of help. He had cycled in and out of hospitals and jails for years. Neely's tragic death unfolded May 1st about 2:30 p.m. after he boarded an F train screaming and threatening passengers, according to a freelance journalist. Penny grabbed him from behind, dragged him to the ground, and allegedly wrapped his arm around his neck until he lost consciousness and later died. So that's the background here. That's the full background of all we know now. And, of course, there are probably more details than that. I mean, out of 42 arrests, out of 42 charges, there is more than that to the story. But here we have an example of a good Samaritan intervening to protect innocent life and other people that are on the train, other passengers. It ended tragically, and now the good Samaritan is being charged criminally. The system is not working. The system is not working. And this starts, you see where this starts. This starts with the breakdown of Neely's family. Where's Dad? Dad's nowhere to be found. Where's Mom? Mom was murdered in 2007 in New York City. Where is the mental facilities? Well, they let him walk. Where are the jails? They let him walk. Where are the prisons? They let him walk. Where's law enforcement? They let him walk. So Daniel Penny gets put in a lose-lose situation and saves people from being victimized, and now he is the one that is facing charges. The system in New York City is completely upside down. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. I've posted a link to the story out of Fox on Jordan Neely's criminal history of violent assaults. And, you know, the Democrats in New York State passed a couple of years ago, passed that what they call no cash bail, which basically means no bail, where they promoted it as, well, look, if you're not a violent criminal, like if you're not a violent criminal, then you ought to be able to get out. You know, if you've, I don't know, gotten charged for a drug charge or, you know, some kind of white collar crime, some kind of financial crime, then you ought to be able to get out, you know, no bail. Don't worry about it. You can walk the same day that you get arrested. And, but this is an example of that. That's not true. They're pushing this as a, well, if you're nonviolent, you get out. No, Jordan Neely got out. Jordan Neely was a known violent criminal in New York City, and he got let out time after time after time. And what our society and what our justice system has to understand is that some people never change. Some people never change, and that's sad, but it's a sad reality. And do we wish that people would change? Absolutely. Do we wish that God would step in and save their life and turn their life around? Absolutely. That should be the wish of all of us. But we cannot operate our criminal justice system, based off of a wishing mentality. I wish things were better. You have to deal with what you got going on at the time. And the truth is that Jordan Neely was a violent criminal. And the system let him back on the streets to victimize more people over and over and over again, 42 times. So this isn't Daniel Penny's fault. This is the fault of Jordan Neely himself and the system itself in New York City. And it's very, very tragic. It's very sad. There's nothing good about the situation, all right? There's nothing good about it. But when a man has to step in and defend innocent people, innocent bystanders, that man should not be demonized and sought after and pursued criminally by the very same system that failed the people of New York City on occasion after occasion. That just is a travesty. And to really just sink New York further in the hole, I came across this other report about what they're doing with these illegal immigrants in New York City. By the way, I find it quite ironic that these big Democrat mayors and governors and lawmakers have been pushing and promoting this illegal immigration y'all come mentality. But when governors like Governor Greg Abbott out of Texas, when they bust these illegal immigrants to New York City, then Eric Adams, the Democrat, the hardcore Democrat, just starts squalling. Oh, you can't send them up here. We can't handle this. Well, your party's been promoting this illegal trespassing of our nation for years now and failing to secure our border, but all of a sudden you don't want to take the illegal immigrants? What's going on here? I thought you guys had the big heart. This will infuriate you here. Listen to this story out of Breitbart. Upstate New York hotels began kicking homeless veterans from their properties to make room for migrants being bused to the region from New York City. Those homeless veterans, many Vietnam-era veterans, were receiving temporary shelter in the hotels through the efforts of a nonprofit agency. So here we have a nonprofit agency trying to do good work and trying to find some temporary housing for these New York hotels, and here come the illegal immigrants that shouldn't even be in the country. They trespass. They cross our border illegally. They ignored our federal immigration laws, and they're booting out these veterans. They're booting them out of the hotel, telling them to go find somewhere else to stay, that we got to house these illegal immigrants. I mean, you talk about the epitome of insulting, of of hypocrisy and of insult. I mean, this is it in New York City, and it's very, very sad. But all these stories really bring us back to this common theme of moral decay, and that's what we have in our country today. Is we have moral decay, and when you boo God, when you push God out, you tell God, no, you're not welcomed here. We don't want you here. When you raise up a generation and generations of people and young people that are being told there is no God, you know, whatever you say is right, this relativistic society, this godless society, when you continue to push that, of which our society and our culture does so often, you get moral decay. You get moral decay. You get the breakdown of the family. Why have a family? You know, that's the family's being undermined through, you know, the whole sexual deviancy movement, the transgender movement, making divorce as easy as buying a car, or easier, actually. All of this comes together, and you get moral decay, and that's what we're seeing now. You know, we wondered for decades, decades of bad decisions, of ungodly leadership, of devaluing the family, devaluing marriage, devaluing parenting and the raising of children. All of this goes together, and some of us wondered, you know, what kind of long-term effect is this going to have? If any, what kind of long-term effect is this going to have? And we're seeing it play out now. We're seeing it play out now, where it eventually leads to the destruction of Western civilization as we know it. Now, you know, is this apocalyptic? Well, maybe not, but it's pretty close. You know, you have Western civilization, you have America, the beacon of liberty and justice and hope for the world for over two centuries now, and you undermine it, and you undermine and devalue the very principles that made this nation to begin with, and then what do you expect to happen? What do you expect to happen? I mean, how can we maintain this bastion of liberty, this bastion of hope? Why do you think everybody wants to come here? Because it's the greatest nation on earth. It's the greatest nation on earth, and it's being undermined very, very rapidly in a very expedited manner. And I call what's happening now the controlled demolition, the controlled deconstruction, if you will, of Western civilization. So that's what we have now. Hey, on a positive note, if we can shift to a positive note so quickly, Daniel Penny's legal defense, that's the Marine vet I've been talking about, his legal defense fund surpassed $2 million in just a week. In just 1 week, Daniel Penny's legal defense fund surpassed $2 million. And I know that sounds like a lot of money, and it is a lot of money for many of us. But to defend yourself against unjust charges, it's going to take a lot of money for Daniel Penny. He's got some good lawyers, it appears. But nonetheless, thousands of Americans have come alongside Daniel Penny and help him raise some legal funds to help defend his character and his integrity. So that's some good news on that front. I think I don't want to try to prophesy here, but if I could project out into the future, which I guess that's what prophesying is doing, I don't think these charges are going to hold up. I just don't think these criminal charges against Daniel Penny are going to hold up, because, you know, Daniel Penny can pretty confidently, pretty easily outline the erratic and dangerous behavior of Jordan Neely on that train. The fact that, you know, there was no law enforcement nearby. It took him like 10 or 15 minutes to get on scene. There were innocent bystanders. I mean, there's a lot of context here that is in defense of Daniel Penny. So I don't think those charges will hold up, but we will see. It's a very, very sad situation. And as I said last week, you couldn't pay me to live in New York City. You couldn't pay me to live in New York State with their upside-down criminal system right now. We do have our next guest with us, Mississippi House Speaker Philip Gunn is on the line with us. Philip, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon. Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Hey, House Speaker, I want to cover a few things that happened this legislative cycle in Mississippi. But before I do that, I want to kind of pick your brain about your retirement. So you're retiring. This is your last session. This is your last year, if you will, in Mississippi. You've been House Speaker for several years now. What led to your retirement? What made you come down with the decision that this session, that this year is your last year in the Mississippi legislature?
Well, I feel like we are at a high point given all the things we've accomplished here in Mississippi over the last 12 years. I think it's time for me to see what else the Lord may have for me to do in the way of service. I'm very proud of the accomplishments we've had over the last 12 years, but I feel like that now is the time for me to explore other opportunities, and I've not yet dismissed the possibility of running for other office, but the time was right for me to hang up my legislative service, and we'll see what else God has in store for me.
Hmm. Well, that's encouraging. You know, a Speaker Gunn, it's not often that that lawmakers voluntarily hang up their hat, even if it's just for a season. That's pretty encouraging to see that you have a life outside of politics, so that's good to see that we don't see often nowadays. Hey, this last cycle, this last legislative session was very busy. A lot got done. What are some highlights of this last session that you're proud of, that you're proud of Mississippi for?
Well, I will go back to the overturning of Roe versus Wade last June. Many people may or may not know that the bill that was used to overturn Roe versus Wade is one that started in the Mississippi House back in 2018. Since I became Speaker in 2012, we have made a great emphasis on the pro-life agenda, protecting the sanctity of life for the unborn. I think I counted four or five, maybe six different bills that we passed over this period of time, which are pro-life in nature. In 2018, we once again passed a bill called House Bill 1510, which was designed to prevent an abortion after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Like most of these bills, it was challenged, struck down by the Fifth Circuit, and went nowhere. But little did we know that the Lord was going to use that one to work its way all the way through the legal system to reach the United States Supreme Court. And in 2018, it didn't look that optimistic. We had a court at that time that was still in the pro-choice, pro-Roe versus Wade mindset. But the Lord knew that in 2022, that composition of that court would change. They would become more constitutionally minded, and the decisions they made returned those decisions regarding abortions to the states, which was a huge accomplishment. And if someone asked me the other day if I could point to one thing in my legislative career that I'm the most proud of, I would say that leading the Mississippi House of Representatives to pass that bill, which changed the landscape of abortion in this country, is without a doubt the largest accomplishment we've ever done.
Yeah.
In light of that, we set out, or that I think highlighted the importance of the pro-life, pro-family agenda. And so this last session, to answer your question, was focused on creating strong families, focusing on that pro-life, pro-family policy that was so important to those of us who are in the pro-life movement. So we passed a whole host of legislation. We call it a pro-life agenda. We did tax credits for crisis pregnancy centers. We did tax credits for adoptions. We increased tax credits for transitional homes. These are homes that exist for women who have aged out of the foster care system. They're beyond the age of 18, but they're not yet ready to get on their feet. These are places that they can go and receive support and help. We, like I said, doubled the tax credit for people to adopt. We passed a law that made adoption more streamlined, it made it cheaper. We increased the efficiency of our safe haven drop boxes. These are for women who don't want their child, but they can take them to these places and deposit them, and the foster care system can take them and make sure that child is placed with a loving family. We separated the Child Protective Services from the Department of Human Services to make them a standalone agency, which allows them to draw down certain federal funds. Probably one of the biggest things we did early in the session was to pass the House Bill 1125, which says we will not allow performance of transgender surgeries on minors.
Yes.
We were one of the first states in the country who did that. Other states have since followed, but protecting our minors from this invasive type of surgery when they're not yet capable of making that kind of decision was a huge step.
Yeah.
In this last session. So those are just about five or six or seven things that we did this last session that are all designed to protect children, protect mothers, grow the family, strengthen the family, and take care of our families.
Well, Philip, they can't say that in your last session you sat on your hands, because that's not a that's not a final year of sitting on your hands. Hey, you've always been a great leader to work with. No twisting arms with you. You're gladly accepting of the pro-life, pro-family agenda, and you pushed that for years and years. Thanks, Philip, for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
All right. That's outgoing Mississippi House Speaker Philip Gunn, an ally to the life and family movement in America, a movement that could truly revitalize this state and this nation. We got to keep it up. We got to keep playing offense. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to the program. Walker Wildman here with you. Don't forget to check out the video. We've got the video up at streaming.afa.net, streaming.afa.net. We're also publishing the show in the form of a podcast each afternoon wherever you listen to podcasts. Just type in At the Core, and when you find the show page, click the subscribe button, and the program will be queued up on your smart device whenever you want to listen to the program there. So there's several ways to listen to the program. Hey, I do want to introduce our next guest. We have on with us Mississippi Secretary of State Michael Watson on the program with us. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, my friend. I really appreciate what you guys do.
Thank you so much. I know you were a lawmaker for some time in the state legislature, and now you're the Mississippi Secretary of State. Hey, there's several issues that fall under your purview that you work on each and every day in the Secretary of State's office. One of those, probably one of the largest, is voting, and the operations of our state, the operation of our state's elections. In the last presidential cycle, 2020, and thereafter, there's been a lot of talk about election integrity, about the whole process. I mean, half of America has become a semi-expert in how America's elections operate. It's very, very fascinating how we're structured. And probably for, you know, over two centuries, there's not really been any doubt about, you know, is America's election process and processes, is it up to par? Is it up to speed? What are you learning? What are you finding out as Secretary of State about Mississippi's and just overall elections in this nation?
Sure. Specifically talking about Mississippi, I'm very proud of our process here. And folks need to know Mississippi is a bottom-up state, meaning the really hard work happens at the local level with our circuit clerks and our commissioners. So one of the things we did first, we went to all 82 counties and visited with our clerks and commissioners and really tried to build those relationships because it takes a team. Elections are hard. So making sure everybody's on the same page and open lines of communication is key to what we're doing to be successful. And I learned a lot from them, and I think it's important that folks know that, you know, again, it's not just the Secretary of State, it's the commissioners and the clerks as well. So we talked to them, and really coming into office in 19, being a three-term state senator, we had already done some elections legislation and worked on that. But then when we saw 20, I think it was really key for us to return voter confidence to the process. And again, with our decentralized system, bottom-up, I think it's important for folks to know Mississippi's safer than a lot of states, I would say, because of the process and how it works here. That said, we can never rest, and I think it was important for us to set some goals and some guidelines for the legislature to encourage them to do a few more things to further secure our vote, and we've done just that. So I can run through a laundry list of the things we've done the last 4 years, and I think it's really important, Walker, to point out that it's from listening to Mississippians. It's not just our ideas. It's ideas that we heard on a campaign trail. It's ideas we heard from the circuit clerks and the commissioners. It's a really important work happening here, but I hope Mississippians know that we're focused on election integrity. As a matter of fact, I was just invited last weekend to speak down in Florida about the progress we've made in Mississippi. So we're one of the national leaders right now in reforming our elections process to make it even safer to vote here in Mississippi.
Yeah, it's a lot of it gets into the weeds, but and a lot of it's really deep process items. But to your point, you know, making sure our elections are free and fair is really at the heart of our country, and ensuring that we remain free in the years and decades and centuries to come. Hey, specifically on the topic of election integrity, one thing that I've seen various reporting on, specifically in California and other more left-leaning states, where they've got people on the voter rolls that are about 150 or 160 years old. I mean, it's just absolutely laughable. And when you talk about, hey, let's clean up these rolls, let's like make sure that when someone's death certificate comes across our desk that we actually take them off the voter rolls, you mention that to any liberal and their head spins. They're like, why would we remove them? That's a voter suppression, et cetera, et cetera. What have you done in Mississippi to make sure that our rolls, the rolls of registered voters, is the most up-to-date and accurate information available?
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of said that a little bit in jest, but I know you meant it. And I'll tell you this, Virginia, actually, they were trying to do some voter maintenance, and one of the pieces they're working on is getting dead people off the rolls. And the left actually said, you're engaging in voter suppression by taking dead people off the rolls. I mean, and that's true. That's serious. That actually happened. So I'll tell you, when we came in, we had 43 of our 82 counties that had 90% or more of the voting age population on the registered voter rolls. We had 7 counties that had 100% or more, with the worst being 107%. So just a quick example and understanding why this is important, and we'll say Lee County, which, by the way, it's not happening in Lee County, but I know you guys are in Tupelo. Mm-hmm. Say Lee County had 100 people. Well, if you have 107% on the registered voter roll, that means that on election day, you actually have 107 people instead of 100 people. So you've got 7 extra ballots out there. That's the importance of making sure you've got clean voter rolls. So we sent letters to all 43 of those counties basically saying, look, do your jobs. We want to make sure that you're keeping your voter rolls clean. And if you don't, we're going to, you know, make sure that you're famous for that. And then number two, we started posting on the internet here, our website here, and you can check every month. We put numbers up and how the counties are doing with cleaning their rolls. And I did that for two reasons. Number one, when we go around, I try to educate folks. Who has the responsibility of cleaning the voter rolls? Well, it's your elections commissioners, and in some instances, your clerks. But if people don't know that, they don't know who to hold accountable. So you tell them that first, and then second, you give them the tools so they can actually see those numbers. We've got that down a good bit now. I spoke to our commissioners at an event. I walked in on a Friday morning, and my assistant secretary of state said, they're not real happy with you right now. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, they got that letter, and they also heard about the internet, the website you're putting up, their numbers. So basically, as diplomatically as I could, I told them, hey, look, you do your jobs, and we won't have any problems. So we've done a really good job of that, of pressing that issue. This year, the legislature passed House Bill 1310, which had several components in it. And one of the most important components of it, Walker, was voter roll maintenance. And so we codified what we're actually doing already. That was in federal statute, federal guidelines, but not in state statute. And I think that's important because, as you've seen, as we've seen, there's an attack on elections at the federal level. And if we didn't have anything here in the statute in Mississippi, you know, it'd be really hard to claim the 10th Amendment and fight really hard for what we had on our books here. So we want to make sure we got that done. Within that, we added several other provisions, which are called triggering mechanisms. And a triggering mechanism is basically, look, if a voter moves away and, you know, they get a piece of mail that's returned back to the clerk's office, they then get a confirmation card sent to their home. If they don't respond to that confirmation card, that's when the process to clean them off the voter rolls starts to take place. So we got that into statute here in Mississippi. Really proud of that. We've also made sure that only United States citizens are voting in our elections. We started talking about that in 2019, and it was, if you remember, it actually started at a school board election in California. And people kept saying, well, Michael, that's out in California. That's never going to happen. Well, as we all know, those things start to matriculate across the country. And now we're seeing in states all around our United States. So we made sure that we got our voter rolls cleaned up there. So no longer can non-citizens be on our voter rolls. And we can also go back with the legislature in 1310. Now we can check our entire statewide election management system to make sure no non-citizens are on a roll. So that was an important piece as well. And I could keep going, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation.
Yeah, no, this is good information. And I'll tell you what, I'm so glad that you've been working with the state legislature to codify some of this into law, because, you know, when you have competent people like yourself running agencies and running departments like the Secretary of State's office, you know, it's easy to go, you know, everything's going good, we're moving in the right direction. But unfortunately, the truth is that we can't always bank on the right people being in the right positions all the time, 100% of the time. And that's, we've seen that in other states where you've got a Democrat Secretary of State that just basically says, I'm not going to do my job. And then it leaves people really in a bind with no way to have a voice on this election integrity topic. So codifying into the state legislature and the state law is, I think, an added measure, if you will, to give voters a recourse, if you will, should other agencies or other departments not really uphold their end of the bargain. Let me ask you this on this topic of election integrity. Getting audits done seems like in the past it has been very challenging to get an audit done. What has your office done to shore up some kind of audit process where if there's reports of abnormalities or even illegality going on, the Secretary of State's office can step in and do an audit?
Walker, great question, and I'll tell you, I'll preface this by kind of what you just said. I tell my folks all the time, I'm not always going to be the Secretary of State, so let's make sure we've got, you know, guardrails in place where we know the thing's going to be done right, even when I'm not here. And I think that's an important look to move forward. But with our post-election audits, what we saw was, and a lot of people said, look, this topic got really important in 2020 after the Trump loss, and so it's just Republicans that are out there kind of crying about losing an election. I love to remind them, you remember in 2016, right after 2016, Hillary Clinton and John Podesta put a group together that did a study on elections. And, you know, how do we reform elections? How do we make them better? Guess what one of their suggestions was? Post-election audits. So it's good for whoever loses, but it's not good for whoever wins. Well, that's just not the case.
Yeah.
So we were able to move that forward this year. We've been working on it for a couple of years. And again, it was one of the pieces that we had to work with our clerks because they're an important piece of this team, but really excited about post-election audits coming up. And so they're going to be procedural audits. And just to make sure that our listeners understand, so all 82 counties are going to be audited over the next 4 years. And so after these elections, basically we'll go in to make sure, hey, did you follow the law? Did you process your absentee ballots correctly? Did you process your affidavits ballots correctly? Did you test your machines correctly? You know, making sure that all of the laws that deal with elections are enforced and are being followed. I think that's an incredibly important piece to make sure that people understand, hey, there is confidence in the process. These people are following the law to make sure that our elections are safe and secure. So really excited about that, and I think that's an important piece. And then lastly, we heard a lot about equipment and machines after 2020. I want to make sure that all Mississippians know by 2024 election, every county in Mississippi now has to have a paper verifiable trail. So if they've got a machine, it's going to have a paper ballot, and that's an important piece. So you can go and see, hey, if somebody's got a question about the machine, you know what? Let's go look at the paper ballot. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, that paper ballot is what's going to rule the day. So I think that's another important piece, and appreciate the legislature supporting our efforts on that.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I'm learning stuff as we go now here on this interview. Hey, last question, Secretary of State. Let me ask you this, and I'm looking for a little bit of honesty here. And you're a politician, but you're also an honest man. On a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel, how confident are you in Mississippi's election process? I know we're probably not a 10, we're probably not perfect, there's always room to grow, But how? Where are you on a scale of 1 to 10 as far as Mississippi's election processes?
Yeah, I'm probably a 9.5, and I'll tell you, there's never a perfect election. And a great example, we just saw this about 2 months ago. And I'll tell you, this voter fraud, it happens. It actually happens. We had a case down in South Mississippi where in a nursing home, if you're in a nursing home, you can request an absentee ballot by mail. It has to be signed, has to be notarized, the types of safety measures on that. But we found an opportunity here where an individual had kept copies of those requests, and they had whited out the dates and continued to use these requests. Well, we got wind of it. We went to vital statistics and found out that these people had actually passed away, but that this individual continued to request their absentee ballot. That's illegal. That's fraud. Mm. Unfortunately, in the statute, basically the provision didn't speak specifically to the ballot request, only the ballot itself. So we had to go in and get that changed in law. And I say that to make sure people understand, we're going to root out every single opportunity, every chance that people have to cheat and close that door. And I think that's another example of people say, well, Michael, that's just not real. Election fraud doesn't happen. It happens. Mm. And so that's why I would say a 9.5. It's hard to find, but when we do find it, we've got to prosecute it and make sure that people understand. We're going to make examples of these folks, because if you prosecute and people know they're going to get in trouble, they're much less likely to do it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Talk about leaving no stone unturned. Hey, Secretary of State Michael Watson, thanks so much for coming on the program.
You got it, my friend. Talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Mississippi Secretary of State Michael Watson. And what's going on here, as I've said over and over again, is definitely applicable for other states, and other states are working on similar issues. I would say, and I've said this, I've said it privately. I'm not sure if I've said it on the show, but, you know, our efforts as government engaged, politically engaged evangelical Christians, our efforts are very well spent at the local and state level. You know, I know that a lot of attention is drawn to Washington, D.C., and there is a lot of power and gamesmanship that happens in Washington, D.C. Much of it is very critical to the future of our nation, to the well-being of our nation. But you can get, to speak in shopping terms, you can get a lot of bang for your buck for time and energy spent at the local and state level. I really think as the more our nation continues to drift towards immorality and other immoral things, it's so important that at the local and state level that we shore up our principles of liberty and freedom and prosperity for the future of our children and grandchildren. Thanks so much for joining the program. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.